Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. I'd like to continue what we did yesterday in a moment, where for the first 300 years, church leaders taught free will and opposed, when the topic came up, they opposed determinism that the future was settled. Also, I mentioned yesterday that the latest artwork from AHA, Abolish Human Abortion, by Russell Hunter, this great piece of art, it shows an elephant inside of a hamster's wheel, running on the wheel, so getting nowhere, running in place. And it says pro-life incrementalism, which is a great point, although we modified it. And you could find that artwork at AmericanRightToLife.org/incrementalism. You'll see it there. And I'd like to give examples of why it's important to add compromised, the word compromised, compromised incrementalism. It's a lot easier, right, just to say incrementalism is bad. But is that true? That's why we focus on the word regulations. All child-killing regulations are inherently immoral. So hopefully we'll get to that. But first, an email from a longtime listener from Oklahoma. Parts of the email, joyous, encouraging, but parts painful. They have the family has recently left their church that they attended for 10 years because of a disagreement over the teaching that everything, including all wickedness, all evil, flows from the mind of God and was decreed by him from eternity past. So there are many people who are finally attuned to defend the righteousness of God, and they recoil against any suggestion that all filth and perversion came first in his mind and flowed as a command or as a decree from God to basically angelic and human puppets who then act out God's script. So that email, let's see, rather than me read it, it's on my phone here. Why don't we bring up Doug McBurney's mic, mic 2 in the studio? And let's see how this sounds. We'll have my phone read this email from Dee Dee.
Hi, Bob. Hope you and your family are doing well. We are still continually blessed by the Lord in keeping up with your ministry daily, whether it's listening to the show, watching Bible studies and sermons, the Bell DVDs, etc. I can hardly let a day go by without being in touch with the minister in one way or another. I'm on my second time around, listening to most of your resources. Even when I listen to a series again, I always catch things I didn't before. Though it's been many years that I have followed your ministry, I never cease to humbly thank the Lord for being drawn to it. As a former miserable Calvinist, I don't think I've ever had a bigger relief in any area of my life over anything than realizing how wrong that doctrine is. I am a happy and blessed open theist with a much greater relationship with the Lord. Over the years, I've become seasoned in my arguments for God's freedom and man's freedom. Like you say, it's best if we know the ammunition, or so-called proof texts, for false teachings better than the adherents do. Growing up hearing and believing the Calvinist arguments over half my life, I've found this isn't so hard for me to do. We are also on the front lines, as much as possible, protesting at the Tulsa abortion mill every week. God has helped us increase the numbers out there so much. The zeal is becoming so great. So many young people coming with great boldness. Listening to your ministry and resources helps to build up my faith so that I can be better prepared with greater boldness and less fear. Again, I feel fairly seasoned when given the opportunity to dialogue with the opposition and defend the unborn child's right to life. So thank you for that. On to another topic. We recently stopped attending our church. The pastor was always very dear to me. I have known him my whole life. He has been like a second father to me. He was a member of the same church when I was a young girl. He went on to pastor another church that we ended up attending. He later went to pastor a church in Oklahoma City, and we went quite a few years with just visiting with him on occasion. He came back to pastor another church in town. He is a Calvinist. When we were finally able to see the error of this theology, it was when he was pastoring in Oklahoma City. When he ended up coming back here to pastor, we decided should we add still check out the church, because we knew that though he spoke of Calvinism occasionally, he limited it enough to not distract too much from the word. He did speak out against wickedness more than most pastors, and we persuaded him to get the church involved in the personhood movement years ago. He was also a supporter of homeschooling and would actually preach against homosexuality from the pulpit. So all things considered, we t going. Unfortunately, he started preaching more and more on Calvinism when his mention of it was occasional. My daughter and I had a thing going where every time he said something regarding this false doctrine, we would poke each other on the side of the leg, very inconspicuously. At first, we might have poked each other once a sermon, maybe a couple of times a month. Then we started poking each other 3 and 4 times every sermon. After a while, it got to where our legs started hurting because of all the poking we were doing. Sadly, it ended up getting so bad, after 10 years, we knew it wasn't good for us to stay there any longer. We told them we were open theists. We never imagined how severe their response would be. We hoped that though it might be sticky, we could still remain in touch and focus on the other like-minded beliefs we shared. But after much dialogue, they ended up telling us that they doubted whether we were even saved. This was a big blow. We are now in the process of trying to find another church. After much research and nearly being exhausted over listening to sermons from various churches, we realize this is going to be difficult. With the scale you give on how to grade a pastor, we haven't been able to find one that will score higher than a D. For now, we will keep calling Denver Bible Church our church home. We may not get to listen in person, but we still have the awesome opportunity to listen to so much remotely. We love getting the monthly sermons. Listening to them in our homes gives us much more meat and sustenance than any local church we have found. Thank you so much for making them available. On to yet another topic. There are several drag queen story hours going on this month in Tulsa. We have a group that is planning on going to protest these events. We will be bringing various signs, some being scriptures against homosexuals. I would like to be better polished on some arguments against it. I wondered if there was an archived debate or resource that you could give me that would help me to be better prepared when given the opportunity to dialogue. Thank you so much for your time, as I'm sure you are probably one busy minister in Christ. Dee Dee.
Wow, that was something. Dee Dee, thank you for that email. Parts of it wonderful, parts very painful to hear. On that last note, we had a debate with a homosexual. By the way, all of our debates are listed online at kgov.com/debates. So they're easy to find. One of those is at kgov.com/homosexuals. You could type it that way. You could type /homosexuality. You'll find it. And not only is there the debate with the leading homosexual activist named Wayne Besson, but there's also a list of the Bible verses in the Old and New Testaments that condemn homosexuality, and a list of the arguments against homosexuality showing how perverse it is, how unworkable it is, and that it should be recriminalized. We need to re-stigmatize homosexuality, recriminalize it, and work toward homosexuals repenting. All right. So Dee Dee and her family, they have a pastor who's a Calvinist, and he's obsessed. I wonder if Dee Dee heard yesterday's show when we talked about the first 300 years of the church teaching genuine free will, that your will is truly free, because there were plenty of philosophers. It was a Hellenized culture. Greek philosophy was saturated in the concept. So was Latin philosophy, saturated in the concept of providence. On Providence, you could look that up, by Seneca 2,000 years ago. And, of course, Plato and Aristotle and Neoplatonism, where they claimed there actually was no such thing as human free will. In fact, even Zeus wasn't free, because even though the Fates, the three daughters of Zeus, even though they were his daughters, still Zeus himself was caught up in fate. He couldn't change what would certainly be. And it turns out that Calvinism, introduced long before Calvin, in the time of Augustine, came into Christian doctrine because of Augustine's obsession with the Neoplatonists. That's what we talked about yesterday. So I don't know if that's what led to Dee Dee telling us now about their family and their church experience. But why is it that some Calvinist churches are obsessed with Calvinism? Why is that? Well, it's a psychological defense mechanism, right? When you're guilty about something, what do many people do? They double down. When a Christian teaches that God is the author of evil, that God is the one who has decreed all wickedness, and then they have these secondary agents, you know, who work out the wickedness in their theology, but ultimately, every thought, every action, every decision flows from God's mind. It was in God's mind long before, say, Adolf Hitler was conceived. It was in God's mind, the Holocaust. And so when that is your belief system, then you become obsessed, right? Because of this psychological defense mechanism. It's like a husband arguing with his wife, and when he's wrong, the more obviously it becomes that he is wrong, oftentimes, the more angry he gets. Does that ring true to anybody? It's not only a husband and a wife, it's also a wife and, you know, it's human nature because of our pride. The more obviously a person is wrong, oftentimes the more angry they get. And so when you look at a church and you see churches that are obsessed with certain things, like a church obsessed with speaking in tongues, just obsessed, well, they've probably got something out of whack. A church obsessed with exorcism, right? Deliverance ministries, obsessed, as though that's the thing. Somebody's an alcoholic, you got to cast the demon of alcoholism out of there. You know, not one time in the entire Bible do we find someone struggling with the sins of the flesh, and the solution is you get that kind of demon cast out of you. I mean, there was demon possession, obviously. Not once did we see in the entire Old Testament, did we see a single exorcism, not once. Even though there was demonic activity, but there was no demon possession, no exorcism until the short period of the New Testament when the spiritual warfare was at its peak. And that's when we saw demon possession and exorcism. But if your church is obsessed, doesn't just teach on occasionally, but is obsessed with the end times, that easily is a symptom. If your church is obsessed with tithing, if it's obsessed with Calvinism. Now, just because you're obsessed with something doesn't mean that thing is wrong, because it's possible to be obsessed with the truth. But the truth tends to be broad in its scope. So let's say Denver Bible Church. I'm familiar with that fellowship. Denver Bible Church, if somebody were to say it's obsessed, yeah, it's obsessed with about 15 or 20 different topics. Obsessed. We're studying this week Jeremiah chapter 7, and the things that God lays out at the beginning of the chapter, why he is against his own people, why he is not going to defend or protect his own people, it's because of God lays out the topics one after another, and they're all the things that we're obsessed with here at Bob and Yurt Live in Denver Bible Church. And we've been teaching through the Bible verse by verse for years. We're more than halfway done with the scriptures. Much of the New Testament is done, much of the Old Testament. And we find in chapter after chapter that the things that God puts the focus on, the priority on, that these are the things that we believers, those who follow Christ, those are the things that we should emphasize. But whereas in the whole Bible, maybe 0.1% of it deals with exorcism, you have churches where that's their ministry, their deliverance ministries, which actually they're not, but they trick themselves into it, and the obsession is partly a defense mechanism because of this psychological defect, and actually because of their sin, of laziness and then pride, they dig in to make it the most important thing ever. Rather than recognize, hey, we're a little out of whack here. No. Baptism, let's say you have a church and baptism is their main thing. It's their main thing. The Apostle Paul says that, I thank God that I didn't baptize hardly any of you people. And Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. You're not going to find a Church of Christ leader saying that. So oftentimes when you're wrong, it's the thing you make into the most important thing. All right. So this brings us back to the first 300 years of the Christian church and what the church fathers, those who were bishops of the various cities where the church had become strong, the early church fathers left a legacy. It certainly their writings are not equivalent to the Bible, not in any way. But their writings are valuable to help falsify, to disprove claims about the history of the church that are wrong. And Calvinists typically claim that they faithfully continue the teaching of the early church, and that's just not true. So yesterday we began with an Oxford professor of historical theology, Alistair McGrath, who is a sympathizer with Augustine. He's not against the guy. He's an Augustinian sympathizer, but he admits that before Augustine, the church leaders wrote with practically one voice in asserting the freedom of the human will. And then I began describing a book called God's Strategy in Human History. Great book, a new edition out in the year 2000 by Marston and Forster. And they have one chapter at the end of the book where they lay out the case that free will was taught, genuine free will. In other words, there is no decree or overarching plan under which your decisions have to conform with that overarching plan, that your will is actually free. Someone could decide to murder or not murder, actually. And so they go through the first century, and it's so interesting. They point out that the Christian leaders in the cities of Alexandria and Antioch and Athens and Carthage and Jerusalem and in Cappadocia and Rome, that and many others, that they were teaching genuine free will, something that Calvinists will call libertarian free will. Determinism, right, that this kind of fate or destiny had been taught by the pagans in Samaria, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Gnostics, the Neoplatonists, the Stoics. But it was the Christians, and yesterday I gave quite a list by name of the early church fathers who explicitly affirmed the biblical teaching of free will, and some of them explicitly opposing the concept of destiny or providence or fate that was unavoidable and that your decisions and actions had to comply with that. So it's not true. It's simply not true that the early church teachings are continued by the reformers, and then again by Augustine himself and Thomas Aquinas and Luther and Calvin. No, quite the contrary. So in his book, Confessions, St. Augustine, and we mentioned this yesterday, so just briefly, he is obsessed with the Greek philosophical notion of utter immutability, that God cannot change in any way. And he writes that whatever the cause of evil, whatever that is, and what's the cause of evil? Well, it's either God or God's creatures, right? That's the cause. It's either God or God's creatures. And he doesn't want to just come out and say what the cause is. So he finesses it. And he says, whatever the cause of evil is, I would accept no explanation that would force me to believe that God can change. No explanation. So in other words, he's saying that whatever the cause of evil is, it has to have been with God for eternity past. Because otherwise, here's God, and then here comes evil, and then God's relationship to evil is a change. I recently read a great book published by the Oxford University Press, a new book, 2016, by Richard Mullins. It's The End of the Timeless God is the title. And I'd like to quote to you, he quotes from a Christian writing on the Trinity from back around 350 AD, right? 350 AD. So this is before Augustine's influence. And what he writes, you could find on our webpage, kgov.com/time, how we talk about God being in sequence and God existing in time, and that the incarnation is the strongest evidence that God exists in time, because God the Son for eternity past was not a man. Then he became a man, and now for eternity future, he is the man, Jesus Christ, God the Son. So here is what the Bishop of Poitiers in France wrote in his work on the Trinity. Quote, now obviously an English translation. Quote, it is one thing that he was God before he was man. Another, while on earth, that he was man and God. And another, still now since his ascension, that after being man and God, he was perfect man and perfect God. Do not then confuse the times and natures in the mystery of the dispensation. For according, and there's a word that many Christians today, they don't know, dispensation. And there are many Christians who recoil against the word, even though it's a biblical word, the economy. God's house rules for Israel, his house rules for the body of Christ, and so on, his dispensation. So this bishop from 350 AD writes that the dispensation, for according to the attributes of his different natures, he must speak of himself in relation to the mystery of his humanity, in one way before his birth, in another while he was yet to die, and in another as eternal. So this bishop from 1700 years ago, so brilliant, saying that, look at the incarnation. That tells us exactly God's relationship with time, because God changed. God has a past. God the Son had not been a man for eternity past. And then he was a man, and now he's the resurrected man. I mentioned yesterday the Oxford PhD who's an expert on Augustine, Ken Wilson. And he has a book out this year, 2019, Proof, the Foundation of Augustinian Calvinism. And he points out that he documents that Augustine was intensely influenced by Neoplatonism. That's Plato and the school that followed Plato. Not only was he intensely influenced by Plato, but also by Stoicism and the Gnostics, and a branch of the Gnostics that were intensely deterministic. And Ken Wilson points out that Augustine did not find his opposition to genuine free will from the Apostle Paul, not at all. He found it from these pagan Greek philosophies. And then he points out that Luther and Calvin, they were mistaken when they believed that Augustine was merely teaching what all the earliest church fathers had taught. They were completely wrong on that. And so Augustinian Calvinism is exposed as built upon an unstable foundation of pagan sand. Wow. And then you think of people like R.C. Sproul and his Ligonier Ministries. when they say, you know, without a doubt, Augustine is the most significant extra-biblical theologian of the first 1,000 years. And that's true. And then they quote somewhat positively that Christian theology is but a series of footnotes to Augustine. So whatever Augustine taught, that's what we believe. Real devastating. We're about out of time. I do want to get to Russell Hunter's meme on pro-life incrementalism, and you could see it at americanrtl.org/incrementalism. There's an article there on good versus bad abortion incrementalism, and it talks about principled incrementalism and compromised. Any incrementalism that ends with, and then you could kill the baby, for example, is a bad law. It's immoral. Like late-term abortion bans, heartbeat bills, clinic regulations, fetal pain bills, parental consent, notification, waiting periods, informed consent, partial birth abortion, so-called ban. Whenever it depends how you kill the baby or when or where, then that's immoral. And it turns out that's not even really incrementalism because that stuff prolongs the abortion battle. Now, examples of principled laws that are incremental are, for example, laws based on the book of Exodus, chapter 21, that are fetal crime bills that say during the commission of a crime, if a criminal indirectly injures or kills an unborn child, that criminal should also be punished for the crime or the death of that unborn child. Now, that's not a personhood bill. It's not an abortion ban, but there's nothing immoral about it because it doesn't imply that abortion should be legal. Divesting pension funds from companies that perform or support abortion, right? That's incremental, but it's not immoral. Parental involvement in medical care, as long as there's no mention or reaffirming of child killing, if somehow it became clear that if you perform some type of elective medical care on a juvenile without the parents' involvement, that that's a crime, right? That doesn't affirm child killing. Prohibiting embryonic stem cell research, preventing insurance coverage for killing unborn children, preventing funding of abortion. These are all not only government funding, but any funding. These are things that could be done like on your day off, on your weekend off, when you're on vacation. The abolitionist, the personhood advocate, could recognize these as, hey, they're not going to end abortion, but they're not immoral. So it's compromised incrementalism that is immoral. And in fact, it does more than get you nowhere. You go backwards. And so even if we were to abolish human abortion, AHA, abolish human abortion, that doesn't protect the children in a fertility lab, in a petri dish or a test tube, because there is no pregnancy there. So personhood, though, protects all those kids. God bless you guys.